What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 117, Olympic Challenges, recorded November 5th, 2014. Our guest this week is an athletic trainer at the Olympic Training Center, Jenna Street. I am your host, Jeremy Jackson. Today, right beside me is...
Jose.
Shakira. Gabby.
And then joining us, we have...
Tashari.
All right, Tashari, you got to move up closer to the mic.
I'm Tashari.
There you go.
Dr. Josh Hillen.
And...
Will Ryan.
Leslie.
Jess.
And Jess. All right, so if you want to join our conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com has the live stream. If you want to earn the credits, you have to go to the CEU live event, register there, click on that email, and then you'll be able to earn. It'll record your time. It'll earn your CEUs that way. If you just want to throw in your 2 cents, you can use the hashtag TheSMB, and Matthew Bravo is over here. No, Matthew's on Twitter? Yeah, Matthew's on Twitter today. The Ustream social feature. Bernice is over there, should be looking at that. And all of that stuff is on our website at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. But without much further ado, we're going to get straight to Ms. Street.
Ms. Street, please tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Jenna Street, and I am currently the coordinator of Sports Medicine Clinic Operations for the United States Olympic Committee. I'm based out of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I've been with the USOC for approximately six years now, pardon me. Part of my duties, I am 50% administrative, and I am 50% clinical, where I work as a physician extender on the clinic floor. Part of my administrative duties includes managing the Sports Medicine Volunteer Program, where we bring in healthcare providers within sports medicine from across the country to come work with us for a few weeks throughout each year at all three locations. I'm also the lead and the point for the emergency action plans, emergency procedures, and the day-to-day scheduling for practice and neurotrauma sport coverage.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That's impressive.
All right, so just before we get started, I wanted to clear up some terminology because when I know you work with the Paralympians specifically. So again, so that I'm clear and that anybody else is listening, Special Olympics, the one like when they have the Olympics for the kids with Down syndrome, that's not the same as what it you're working with, correct?
Correct. So you have the Olympians and you have the Paralympians. And honestly, we don't classify the athletes, but the biggest differentiating classification for them is for the Paralympic athletes usually have to have a physical or a visual impairment as opposed to anyone else. And so they may be missing a limb, it may be a birth defect, they may be visually impaired, things of that nature. Whereas the Special Olympics are cognitive disabilities.
All right.
Is there a specific qualitative impairment you're looking for? So for instance, if you know, what would classify as a physical impairment? I mean, obviously missing a limb, being blind, etc. But what are some other determining factors that you all look at?
So it depends on the sport, in which sport they participate in. Each sport has its very own, very specific classification process each athlete has to go through to ensure that when they are competing against individuals with very similar classifications, and so it's an equal playing field.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
How do a high school student like me or MAT student get to work with Olympic athletes?
So there's quite a few different avenues you could take. For me personally, when I was going through school, getting both my bachelor's and my master's, I worked with athletic trainers who had been involved or were currently involved with the Olympic movement. And after hearing about their experiences and seeing the things that they had been able to do and how positively they spoke of it, I knew it was an avenue I wanted to pursue. So after I graduated with my master's degree, personally, I applied to the Sports Medicine Fellowship Program, and it was a one-year position with the USOC. At the end of that fellowship, they signed me on full-time, and I've been here ever since. We do have internships throughout the entire company with the USOC, which is an avenue for a student to become involved. Once they become a certified athletic trainer or any other healthcare profession involved within sports and sports medicine, we do have the Sports Medicine Volunteer Program where they can come and work with us for a two-week rotation and be able to work with the athletes at the Olympic Training Centers.
So can I ask what schools you went to for your undergraduate and your master's?
Sure. I have a bachelor's degree in kinesiology with specialization in athletic training from Michigan State University. And I have a master's degree in educational leadership and policy analysis with a concentration in higher education administration from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm.
And going back, you said that you got involved. How, you know, I'm a program director for the MAT program at the University of Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I want to expose my Master of Athletic Training students to what you do, how can you outline the process that I would need to take to do that?
So for the best, probably the first process we would suggest they go through would be to apply to the volunteer program. And the one of the minimum requirements is that they are certified for a minimum of 3 years.
Okay.
All that information is online, but as soon as they become certified, they become a part of the volunteer program, find a rotation that works with their schedule, and then they can actually come out and see it firsthand.
Okay.
That way it's a 2-week rotation, it's not a full-time job, they can kind of get a taste for it and see if it's something they like to pursue further.
And again, in order for them to do that, they need to have already passed their boards and practicing for 3 years.
Correct.
Okay.
What are some challenges you face in your job?
To be honest, the work-life balance is definitely one of the biggest challenges we do face. We are in it to win it. At the end of the day, our athletes have complete dedication to, and therefore as the team behind the team, we have complete dedication to our athletes as well. The sports medicine team here, I work within a multidisciplinary clinic. We have athletic trainers, physical therapists, and chiropractors on full-time staff here, and we all work together daily in and out to help the athletes. When we all leave work, I can guarantee majority, if not all of my colleagues, including myself, will go home and we'll continue that research, or we'll look up at the case studies. We'll work on rehab plans to see how we can improve and help those athletes better the next day. It's not that we have to, it's because we want to, and because we are a part of that team behind the team who is in it to win it and to help those athletes to do everything they can to get on top of that podium. As the multidisciplinary clinic team, we work together daily on each athlete. Very rarely does an athlete come in and just see one of us. And so as we all continue to improve our knowledge and our skills, we work together to make sure we're giving the athletes that best care. Personally, as an athletic trainer, as part of that team, I'm definitely respected on the clinic floor and have administrative tasks, and also act as a physician extender on a daily basis. For us, the Olympic calendar isn't every 4 years or every 2 years. But we actually have competitions, large world stage competitions every year. This year alone, we've had 3 Olympics that have occurred. We had the Winter Sochi Olympic and Paralympic Games. We also had the Youth Olympic Games in Beijing, China this year in August. Next year, we're ramping up in I believe July and August, we'll have the Pan American and Para-Pan American Games in Toronto. And then the year following that, we're gonna roll right into the 2016 Rio Games. So our schedule is always go, go, go for that, getting ready for the next competition for those athletes.
And do you travel as a part of your job?
I do. Yep. So we travel usually once or twice a year with specific team for teams that they request it to, usually their world championships or world team cups. And also the full-time staff is part of the base staff for the Olympic and Paralympic Pan American and Para-Pan American Games. So I was in Beijing, China in August helping cover the Youth Olympic Games this year, for example.
Mm-hmm. You know, in 2004, I worked with the Olympic trials for USA Swimming.
Oh, wonderful.
And it was one of the best experiences I ever had. I was overwhelmed with the amount that went into that. You know, from obviously you're watching something like this from your TV screen. And, you know, you understand that, of course, the process and the you know, the picture that you just outlined exists, but once you get on the inside of that and you see all of the moving parts
mm-hmm.
that happen with all of the athletes that are working towards the Olympics and everything that goes into that and the quality of care and the communication that happens with all the entities, it's a really overwhelming, you know, experience. And it takes a while. I can imagine it took you a few years to really kind of get settled into the leadership position that you're in right now.
Yeah, it was definitely challenging. I'm still challenged every day. It's a completely different world. With my education and through going through school, I was definitely in the Big Ten Division I setting, and then going to the Olympics was just a whole new, a different world, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. What adaptations have you done to make and caring for, how do you say that word?
All right, so when we talked to a guy that did rodeo athletic training, and so one of the things he told us was they'll do a hip spike with a TheraBand, And so, you know, where I would have never thought about doing the, instead of just using the ace band, you would use the TheraBand because it pulls harder. So obviously you work with a different population, but some of the things that you see or you create there are useful for us in the athletic training room that aren't working with elite athletes or, you know, Paralympic athletes. So what are some of the things that you guys have come up with, or some of the things that are non-standard practices that you guys do there at the OTC?
Non-standard. So we're a very manual therapy heavy clinic. So we do a lot of hand salon, a lot of soft tissue, a lot of mobilizations and muscle energy, and just a lot of manual therapy as part of our treatment. We do work with a wide variety of athletes. We have over 55 national governing bodies, so over 55 different sports. And then within each sport, you have the disciplines for each specific different sport specialty. And it more or less depends on the athlete and what we're working with. An example would be when working with an athlete who is in a wheelchair, doing a simple thumb spike out or taping a wrist takes on a whole new dynamic when you need to make sure that it's not going to rip or break or get rubbed raw or impair an athlete not only doing their sport. For example, if they're playing wheelchair tennis, being able to grip the racket and grip the wheel of their wheelchair to be able to move around the court. It's a lot of thinking on your feet. There's really no one go-to that we have. We treat each athlete as an individual, let it be an Olympian or a Paralympian. It doesn't truly matter to us. And depending on what that sport-specific need is, we will put all of our heads together and do what we can to make sure it is as sport-specific and as functional for those athletes.
Can you go back real quick? You know, you act as a physician extender at the OTC. Can you elaborate a little bit more on your specific job duties and how you got into that role?
Sure. So on the clinic floor, I am definitely a physician extender, and we all do almost all roles on the clinic floor. I'll do the pre and post-op, care for our patients, as well as the rehab and helping with the return to sport criteria and helping them get to that physical condition to be able to return to sport. I work very closely with not only my chiropractic physicians on staff here, but our local physicians, our orthopedics, and our primary care that we consult with on a daily basis to help make sure we are doing everything we can in the best interest of that athlete. We work together on all the cases, and very rarely is there a case where we don't work together or only one provider works on that patient, but we'll consistently be bouncing ideas off of each other, and all opinions are respected and utilized in the clinic with any given patient. Mm-hmm.
And so as the physician extender role grows in athletic training, can you elaborate a little bit more on what you think a student entering the profession is going to need to know about that role?
Sure. So, I mean, it's a very important role. It's a very valuable role where athletic trainers feel very well equipped and knowledgeable in order to help with the being in that physician extended role and helping with that communication pathway to the physician from the patient, and also being able to help that athlete or patient understand exactly what their injury or illness is and how it's going to affect either their activities of daily living or returning them back into sport. I feel it's a vital role for the athletic trainer to be able to help bridge that gap between the return to sport, return to play, between physician and the athlete.
And was that a role that the Olympic Training Center had previously, or was that a role that you developed along the way?
It's a role that has overall developed along the way. There's been a lot of change, and through the philosophy and the staffing of the sports medicine quite a few years back now, before my time. So where now it's just kind of the role that has developed with the philosophy and the function of the clinic.
Mm-hmm. So just a random note here. Yesterday we actually asked Jenna, we did a test call, and one of my students, Bob, he is a Taekwondo teacher, and he is learning from Gene Lopez, who is also an Olympic Taekwondo coach. Mm-hmm. So Jenna actually knows the boss of my student right here.
Cool.
I know last time we were talking about connections and small world and stuff like that. And so it's very strange that guy that coaches my one student here in Pasadena knows Jenna there.
Jenna, what year did you come out of Michigan State?
I came out of Michigan State in 2006.
Okay. You know, I worked with a guy. He's there now. He's the head basketball athletic trainer, Quentin Sawyer.
Yes.
You know Q.
I do know Q.
Right. So there's an example of connections. Q and I were together at Southeastern Louisiana University. And he came out shortly after a guy, Tony Trombetta. And Tony and I were at Southeastern together, and Tony hired Q.
Mm-hmm.
And then Q was with us, and then he went to Campbell University, and then he ended up at Michigan State.
Yep, and once he got to Michigan State, it's when he and I connected, and then he actually became a part of the volunteer program and did a few weeks to help us out in Lake Placid.
Right.
And we definitely still keep in contact, definitely.
How about that? So, I mean, there's an example I tell my students all the time. Jen and I have never met until just now.
Correct.
And, you know, probably have never heard of each other's names until just now. But the athletic training circles, there's always a connection. So I went one degree out, and she and I know a commonality. And so hopefully through that, we'll be able to build some more relationships. And, you know, through that, what I'd like to do is at some point, you know, have you speak to our Master of Athletic Training program. You know, this is an entry-level master's degree. And obviously they can't go and work with you until they've been out and practicing for 3 years. But I at least want to be able to develop that pipeline so that if there are some interested parties or interested students, that they have a route, you know, a direct route to get there.
That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, great.
So, Jenna, you don't mind me asking, what's like your typical day, like from the beginning to the end? How many like athletes do you see a day, or... like, do you venture out to different places? Like, what's your typical day?
I think a typical day is going to be hard because no 2 days are ever the same. Generally speaking, I'll be in the clinic from between 8 and 5 and 8 to 6, Monday through Friday. Usually get in. I usually will see anywhere between 3 to 5 or 6 patients in the morning, and the same thing in the afternoon, depending on the clinic load. I could see 3 or 4 patients throughout the entire day, or I could be seeing 10 or more patients, depending on who all is in town and how many people we have on campus needing care. We do cover neurotrauma sport on campus. We cover all wrestling practices as well as men's gymnastics practice. I require to have medical personnel mat side or in the gym when they are practicing. So I help coordinate those schedules, and occasionally we'll jump in and help cover those practices as well. If there's any emergency that we get called to on campus, I'm usually part of that response team. Doing administrative work, like helping maintaining that volunteer program and making sure that schedule and those rotations and that is kept up to speed. And then I'm also one of the liaisons with the other departments on campus to make sure all the events coming on campus have the proper medical coverage, or they know that policies and procedures and access, emergency action plans and things like that. So it's a combination between clinical care, responding to emergencies if they exist, as well as holding meetings, and just keep helping keep the clinic running smoothly.
So quick question on that. So you guys, you know, have, again, you're working with elite athletes. Do the practices, again, at a high school, a practice is supposed to go 2 hours. It's like 2.5 hours, and then they're just now starting to do conditioning. Do y'all have that deal where you're just sitting and waiting for practice to end, or is it a pretty tight schedule there at the Olympic Training Center?
They're usually pretty good about keeping to their schedule, because when they do their conditioning, it's usually with our strength and conditioning staff in a different venue. So very rarely does their practices run extremely long or extremely over. Because they also understand that we do not have providers who are assigned specifically to just one team, and not only do those providers covering practice have practice coverage duties, they also have clinical duties. So if those practices run over in time, it impedes upon and interferes with patient care in the clinic, because then that clinician is missing that patient appointment. So we've actually worked really hard with the practices on campus and the NGBs, and they usually work very well with us, understanding that we'll do as much as we can for them, but practices running 3 hours over is not truly an option.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Hey, listen, practice was supposed to be at 3, but we're going at 6. Yeah, I don't think so.
Exactly.
I want to go back and I want to ask, if you were going to talk to some students that are starting to enter the field, mm-hmm. and working with the Olympics in a capacity that you work in is something that they want to do. You know, you've got some really unique background, right? So you got your athletic training degree from Michigan State, and then you got your master's degree in ed leadership from Wisconsin-Madison. I was out there a couple times, so I'm inclined to say go Badgers. And so, you know, you've got some real, you know, you've got some leadership background. Can you kind of describe the process if you were going to create a replacement for what you do, or you're going to add to your team? What qualities are you looking for?
The team player is by far one of the biggest things that we look for. Someone who understands the team aspect and is willing to bounce ideas and work with others and does not work as an individual. The leadership quality is definitely there, as we all have administrative tasks, administrative duties, and we are viewed as, you know, leaders in the clinic. You have the athletes looking up to you and looking to you for guidance and help when they need it. We also look for those who have the experience, who have had a wide variety of experiences, let it be volunteering or have worked with the sports outside of the norm, or is willing to look and willing to learn about the sports that you're not used to. Mm-hmm. Before I got to the USOC, I was fortunate. I had not truly worked with in any official capacity, a wheelchair to sport or with an amputee. However, I'd had the exposure and had the knowledge of it, and they threw me in and sink or swim.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, but it definitely was a situation where I learned very quickly where if I don't know, it's not a weakness to ask for help. It's a weakness if you don't ask for help and you try to fumble your way through it. Because we're all here as a team to help and support each other. And if I don't know the answer, one of my teammates do, typically. And so being a team player and just being able to work well with each other and willing to go home and do that research and to, you know, do a little more studying in those areas that you may not hit on in class necessarily as formally as some other areas, that is definitely definitely a need.
And is your current employment, was that in your wheelhouse when you were going through? Is that something that you thought you wanted to do, or is that something that you kind of fell into or that developed over time? How'd that occur?
It was a little bit of both. It is one where after I worked with at Michigan State and Wisconsin and with those athlete trainers who had been involved, I knew about that I wanted to be a sports medicine fellow. I wanted to get that experience. And then what happened was I was actually up in Marquette, Michigan for my first fellowship, and they had asked me to reapply because they wanted me to do a fellowship in Colorado Springs. So then I moved out to Colorado Springs to do a one-year position. Then after that, they offered me a full-time position, and it was an opportunity I just couldn't pass down.
Sure.
I absolutely loved it.
Sure.
All right, so again, we're talking about you're working with elite, world-class athletes, and I went to a training here, and it was with Roland Ramirez of the Houston Texans, and he was saying, you know, I just show me something new, show me something I don't know, and so just on that, where do you find the best trainings or best continuing education opportunities because you are working with the world-class athletes?
There's numerous opportunities out there. I mean, the NHA convention is definitely one that I do attend on an annual basis for numerous reasons, but also to the wide variety of topics and presentations that are available there. Also, other national sports medicine conferences I've also attended throughout the years, including other profession conferences, meaning like physician, physical therapist, or chiropractic sport conferences, just to name a few, as it helps bring a different perspective and to know where the other professions have their focus, where their knowledge is coming from, and what their research is doing. It helps build the common ground within the world of sports medicine, and so we can all work together for those athletes, and it's not necessarily, you know, athletic trainers against or working against another profession. It helps build that bridge where we're speaking the same language as we're looking in at the same presentations and the same research.
Jenna, from where you sit, you know, obviously I'm in athletic training education, and so from where you sit, help me close the gap on educating the students of the future. What are some things that you see from your world that we in athletic training education can do better in preparing the students to meet the current demands?
To meet the current demands is definitely one of the biggest things I tell students on a regular basis, is to not be afraid to ask for help. And it doesn't necessarily have to be from another athletic trainer. Every healthcare provider out there, every profession has their area of expertise, just as we do. And we can build and you can increase and improve upon your areas of weakness. And it doesn't necessarily have to come from an athletic trainer. We're great in supporting each other, but also to help build those bridges across professions is definitely very important. And it's not a bad thing to ask for that help or that support.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, so one of the things you were kind of talking about there is all the different people that you have involved. And that's one thing I love about doing this podcast is last week we had a chiropractor come on. And just in general, athletic trainers don't like chiropractors, but more and more you're seeing them working together, chiropractors being part of the sports medicine team. And so for me to just judge him and say, I don't like chiropractors because somebody else said they don't like chiropractors is, you know, bad. But then I come and talk to him, and he's talking about the soft tissue work he does and the stuff that, you know, he can come teach me some of this other stuff that I'm already heard about in other workshops, like active release or Graston. You know, he was willing to come onto the campus and show me that stuff, that, you know, just building those bridges, working together to for a common goal. You know, I think what you're saying there isn't anything groundbreaking, but it's just something that we all need to hear over and over. So
right.
I think that interdisciplinary team is huge, right? And to me, it comes down to everybody understanding their roles. You know, this is in athletic training, this is our niche, and this is what we're good at, and this is what we're not good at. And so the areas that we're not good at, we need to be able to align with some other healthcare providers so they can close the gap on some of those weaknesses. And you start to build your team. You know, so I would agree. I think that interdisciplinary model is huge, and that ultimately that success is going to come down to everybody understanding their roles. You know, and I think chiropractors in general, where I think they've gotten in trouble is that they've crossed into some areas that they probably should not have crossed into. And we see this in a lot of professions. You know, you see it in athletic training and PT and some other areas. So it sounds like, Jenna, you have, you know, a sustainable model that you're able to employ and that you're able to make changes along the way. Yes. Would you be able to share some of those strategies with us?
Sure. So, for example, for the Associate Sports Medicine team, here in Colorado Springs, I have two physical therapists on staff. There are two physical therapists on staff. We have three sport chiropractors on staff. One is a dual credential DC, ATC. And then we have myself as an athletic trainer. We have two athletic trainers who also work with us on a daily basis from one of our local orthopedic groups who work with us 100% of their time. So it's technically three athletic trainers in the clinic at any given time. And it is one where we know everyone's strengths and weaknesses. And if it's a weakness of mine, I'm constantly working with my colleagues to improve that weakness so it is no longer a weakness. So when I am overseas with an athlete and my colleague is not overseas with me, I can still provide that care to that athlete as efficiently as possible. It's knowing what you know and knowing what you don't know. Every profession has their strengths, and it's a huge benefit to be able to know what those are. And it just gives the best care to the athlete possible that we've been able to see. It's phenomenal.
And how do you guys discover those weaknesses? You know, there's a lot of, like, for instance, in the NATA right now, they're throwing around, you know, things that if you're from the leadership background like you are, you're familiar with the SWOT analysis, you know, SWOT. So how do you guys find those weaknesses, and then how do you all close the gap on that?
So when you find the weaknesses, it's definitely more of a self-discovery, usually for the most part. And it's the willingness to say, you know, if an athlete needs, you know, you do your assessment on the athlete and they truly need to either have this mobilization or this soft tissue or this technique that I've seen but I haven't truly done yet, we're not going to practice on the athletes. We're not going to experiment on the athletes. But I'll tag in one of my colleagues. But when I tag in my colleague, I'm not going to hand that athlete over and then walk away. You stay right there and you listen to the conversations. You watch the setup and you talk them through. And so they can not only educate the patient, they also can help and educate you on what they're doing so you can continue to learn and improve and move forward to be able to apply that new knowledge.
And so what are some of the weaknesses that you've discovered about yourself, and how have you closed the gap on that to improve your clinical practice?
One of the first things that comes to mind for me is when I first started working here, I was not the most efficient with reflexes. I didn't have a system down. I knew the reflexes, but I was kind of all over the place. Where now I've worked with enough individuals who do a phenomenal neuro exam and I've done it so many times and so many athletes. There was one point where I was doing reflexes on athletes just to practice the technique and to make sure I had the feel. So every athlete I saw, before an ankle sprain, a knee injury, or a cervical spine injury, everyone was getting their reflexes checked just to get that repetition. Mm-hmm. To now where I could run you through upper body, lower body, neuro exam, like the back of my hand, because I really put the effort forth in wanting to learn and know that, especially with the populations that we work with and the high volume of neurotrauma that we potentially do see. Mm-hmm. Being able to be proficient with those, with the detailed neuro exam, and then be able to communicate that to my colleagues who now know what I say and what I see, they know I'm proficient in it. They've seen and they've worked with me, so I can have that proficiency.
Right. Interesting.
So kind of a random question. You're talking about going overseas or whatever with your athletes. Are we ever going to see you on TV running out to take care of an injured Olympian?
You never know what the camera's going to catch or the cameras don't catch.
It's always cool for me to see, like, I'll see Roland or I'll see Bob Marley out on the Houston Texans sidelines. And, you know, it's like, hey, I know that guy. So
I'll sit Saturdays and Sundays and text message the people that I know on TV. Hey, I saw you. Hey, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the main reasons I like the admin side. I love the behind-the-scenes side. I love helping coordinate and orchestrate and just watch things happen. When I travel, I typically travel in the past with the wheelchair tennis team to their largest competition of the year. I was at the Paralympics in 2012 with over in London, and then I was in China for the Youth Olympic Games, covering most of those neurotrauma sports as well. So this kind of depends on where we're at and where the need is.
We have a professor at the University of Houston with us. His name is Michael Cottingham, Dr. Cottingham. And Dr. Cottingham is disabled, and he has really championed wheelchair Olympics here in Houston. And he puts on wheelchair rugby in our rec center. And he's really brought a lot of exposure to the Paralympic athlete. And he's been able to partner with TIER at Memorial Hermann and some other entities. So it's really unique, and, you know, from an athletic training perspective, when I was an undergraduate, I took an elective, and it was working with some disabled athletes, and it really opened my eyes to a lot of things that you're saying, Jenna, that, wow, you know, here's where my training is, and here's how I would adapt it. And you can easily cognitively work through that, but when you go to apply it, that's a whole different story, because it's a lot of kind of trial by error. You know, for instance, I would have never thought to do a hip spica with a TheraBand. Not in a million years would I ever thought that. Or some of the techniques that you just brought up, Jenna, I would have never thought about that. So those are things that, you know, I can listen to the two of you and kind of put that in my mental Rolodex and say, you know, if I'm ever in that situation and I need to use, you know, a hip spike with a TheraBand, I can do that.
Yeah. Now, working with the Paralympians, I mean, it's great. We don't classify the athletes. I mean, at the end of the day, they're athletes. The main challenges that we face with that, or I guess we could, would be the only main difference, is that they have occasionally have a lot more significant medical history that you need to be aware of and be able to work through and work within. But honestly, they're just, the Paralympic athletes are the same as any other athletes, and never underestimate the level of competition that they can compete or that they will do. It's a lot of fun.
That's great.
All right. So again, you know, I just want to, did you have something?
Oh, sure. So Jenna, what are some of the things that you've learned working with, you know, athletes who are visually or physically disabled that you didn't learn working with athletes who are not disabled, you know, whether it's psychologically or physically or whatever it may be?
With the visually impaired, it adds a whole new dynamic with the athletes in doing anything, the rehab, the assessment, because they can't see what you're doing or where your hands are and where your hands are going. So it's more of a lot of verbal communication to allow them to know what you're doing and why you're doing it. And then it just takes everything to a whole new level. You can't demonstrate a shoulder exercise or a lunge for the athlete because they can't see the form. It's a lot more visual, it's a lot more hands-on to help them have that learning curve. And then the athletes with on the physical side, it's just thinking outside the box. It's the willingness to sit there with the athlete being like, let's work through this together. I have 7 ideas. Once we work through those 7, we'll probably have 7 more, but let's figure out what's going to work for you. You know, this is not you have to like this tape job or you have to like this splint. We can adjust it. We just need to know what needs to be adjusted so it works best for you. And once the athletes see that you know what you're doing, but you're also willing to say, hey, we need to make sure it works for you, that they will become a part of that process. And I've brought in my sewing machine before to completely redo and fix a brace to make sure it could hold up through certain events or things like that. So just being able to think outside the box, and they tend to have fun with that as well. And they're like, then they feel like they are also able to bring their ideas to the table, which is definitely more than welcome.
They're an active participant in their production. Go back to something you said about, you know, Will mentioned your experiences with visual impairment. So, you know, the first thing that pops up is you must be very proficient in biofeedback techniques.
Yes.
So can you kind of expand on, you know, some of the areas in biofeedback that, you know, obviously going through school, you learn about these different biofeedback techniques, but you, because of those types of situations, you've really added to that knowledge base. Can you talk about some of that?
Sure. One of the main things, being, like I mentioned earlier, we're a very manual-based medicine clinic, and so a lot of it is that tactile feedback, very similar to the PNF philosophy, through the neuromuscular facilitation, and just the communication, both verbal and tactile, with the athlete, is just taken to a whole different level when the athletes are visually impaired. It's one where not only that manual resistance, but even that slight touch of not only your hand, but the TheraBand or, you know, any other apparatus you may be using, just to give them that guidance to make sure that they can complete the exercise just as efficiently as possible. Mm-hmm.
And so the other question that leads me into is, you all probably use, I'm just making an assumption, I could be wrong, but neuromuscular e-stim, where you're getting those muscles to contract. Is that something that you all engage in? Are you obviously, you guys are big in manual therapy, but when it comes to other traditional modalities, what kind of modalities are you all using?
Very rarely, to be honest, they use a passive modality on the athletes, to be honest. We've seen a lot, we've had significant success and greater results without the use of the modalities for the athletes. So very rarely do we really throw a machine on one of the athletes.
Okay. You know, right now our students are in therapeutic modalities, and the one challenge I throw out is, like, explain HIVAMAT. Explain, somebody find me how that works. And so we're going through... And I align with the same philosophy you align with, Jenna, is that I'm going to rely more on manual therapy. I got really lucky when I was going through graduate school. I went undergrad at Cal State Northridge and then grad school at Cal State Long Beach. And so when I was going through graduate school, I had our head athletic trainer that was huge in manual therapy. And so he, you know, if we relied too much on some of those traditional modalities, he really barked at us. And you got good in, you know, manual therapy, manipulation, mobilization, stabilization techniques, you know, PNF, biofeedback, all those other things. And you don't realize that when you get out of that training and then you go to other parts of the country, that there's a real distinctive difference in other people's philosophies and education and what they're comfortable and what they're not comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So can you elaborate a little bit more? You go to the Olympic Training Center, you're essentially out of the Midwest. Can you kind of talk about some of the, you know, the different, I guess, trends in education that you've noticed?
Different trends of education that we noticed, and it actually is really apparent when we have the volunteers come through the clinic, because we'll have volunteers at either athletic trainers, chiropractors, physical therapists, massage therapists, and physicians from all over the U.S. can come through and work with us. And it's really fun to be able to see who's what their go-to is for their treatment or for their care, and who depends on the ultrasound or depends on the stim, and items like that, and then being able to see and work with them. We're very evidence-based and research-based in what we do out of the clinic. So unless it's extremely evidence-based, extremely research-based, and you can prove to us that it's worked time and time and again, you're probably not going to see it in the clinic for the most part. But it is definitely a trend that you see, and it also depends on their setting. Individuals who don't have the ability to see, spend 30, 45 minutes with the patient whenever the patient needs it, is not going to have the ability or the time to do a full manual therapy treatment session if they have 5-10 minutes before a high school practice. Mm-hmm. So I feel like their practice setting also plays a pretty large role in what their comfortable level is when it comes to treatments and modalities.
Okay, so there's not one, you know, what I'm trying to do is pinpoint, you know, one particular path that you all are looking for. So if I go back and I sum it up, they need to be a team player. Mm-hmm. They need to be comfortable in what they know and what they don't know. Mm-hmm. They need to have a wealth of experiences across all practice domains and athletic training. Mm-hmm. They need to be able to work with that interdisciplinary team.
Correct.
They need to understand evidence-based practice, which they're in, you know, intro to research and athletic training now. And what else? So of those five things, what else would you add to that?
I think that'd be a very good place to start right there. I mean, those are all very broad domains and broad areas. I think it definitely does a very good job of kind of doing a snapshot of what we look for and what is we have found to be successful in the clinics.
Okay. And out of curiosity, do you travel? So, I mean, not travel with the teams, but like, if we got you down to Houston, would you come and speak to our program?
Yes, I would.
Great.
You should.
Yeah, that's outstanding. Because, you know, what we're trying to do is that, you know, we're the first athletic training program at the University of Houston, and we're the first athletic training program in the city of Houston.
Oh,
so,
wonderful.
You know, we are in the middle of the largest medical center in the world. And so we have access to all these, you know, incredible resources. And so it's a matter of being able to say, you know, I've been in athletic training now for almost 20 years, and now a matter to say, okay, this is where athletic training is, and this is where it was, mm-hmm. and this is where it is, and this is where it needs to be, and be able to take that and, you know, create as many opportunities for our students as possible so that when they come out, that they have the ability to go, you know, obviously you're a pioneer in what you're doing. So they have the ability to go out and they have to say, look, I want to do what Jenna's doing. And I've got some of these experiences that's going to allow me to do it. And I'm going to take my knowledge base and I'm going to capitalize on this. So
wonderful.
I'm happy to say that if we found a way to get you down here, you'd come and speak.
That'd be fun. I would.
Great. Yeah, I can't hear you.
Mike, they always turn this
off. Yeah, there
mic.
You go.
They always turn it off.
Yeah.
Like them kids. do you guys teach sewing?
Yeah.
I mean, apparently
that's
you're
next
have to
semester.
Know how to sew,
so in the first semester, right, they have an ad. Actually, you know, we should add that in the cadaver
sewing,
lab.
Yes.
Yeah. In the cadaver lab. Yeah, they
sorry,
they
students.
Had they had access to cadavers over the summer, and if we're gonna add sewing, because you're right, Jenna sewed a new brace as she walked in. And it's really, really interesting because, you know, in athletic training, I'll tell you that I've rewired some things in my house as far as putting up new light fixtures, and the only reason why I didn't break down crying is because I was able to relate it back to my understanding of therapeutic modalities. And I thought, well, if I understand how modalities work, of course I'm going to understand how I'm going to be able to put this fixture up. So it's being that jack of all trades and not being afraid to come and say, look, I have this idea and I'm going to sew this together because I think it's going to work. That's great. I love that story.
Yeah.
I love that story.
So, I was wondering what little bit of advice would you give to us entry-level MAT students, like something we could carry with us and something that maybe someone possibly, if it was said to you, you coming through, you probably, you know, would have gone through so much smoother. Like, what's that little bit of advice that you would give somebody that like gives you that extra push?
I think
I'm gonna
stick with the know what you know what you don't know, and know the difference.
Yeah.
Because I think that's huge.
Can you expand about that? So can you talk a little bit about your personal experiences in that?
Sure. Especially coming into the Olympic setting and the multidisciplinary clinic setting and working suddenly with all these different providers on a daily basis, it was the comfort and the confidence to be able to say, I don't know what to do next on this athlete, but I know my colleague on the next table does. It's the ability to say, here's a very complex case that I've never been exposed to, and I truly don't know which direction to take it because my mind's going in 18 different ways. Mm-hmm. To be able to go to a colleague or go to someone who may be in your profession, may not be, and be able to bounce ideas and to be able to take their ideas and to listen to their ideas and actually be able to utilize them and put them into practice if needed.
So you've been practicing now. So if I say that you came out of Michigan State, you passed your boards,
mm-hmm.
and you go through Madison, that was a 2-year graduate assistantship?
Correct.
Okay, so you came out of Michigan State 06?
Correct.
So you've been practicing for 8 years?
Correct.
Okay. So how is your paradigm of you know, thought process in terms of you practicing changed over that 8 years? You know, you just expanded on, here's what I know, here's what I don't know. I'm not afraid to ask somebody to teach me.
Mm-hmm.
But go, if you can rewind 8 years, you know, what kind of professional evolutions have you made along the way?
I've definitely made great strides in not having that cookie cutter go-to treatment or rehab plan for any body part, where it's now a lot more fluid and a lot more athlete individual sport based that changes in a day-to-day process depending on how that athlete is feeling or how the progression is going. Definitely got a lot more fluid instead of having like a set plan for a week and having to stick to that plan. And it's also improved on honestly the evaluations. I used to be very, very cookie cutter where every shoulder had to have every single test done or looking for every single specific process that I used to go through, where depending on what I'm seeing in the test, it's a lot more fluid, where I might take the shoulder exam, so it'd probably lead to a thoracic and cervical exam when it comes to mobility, and maybe look at their breathing techniques, and they have it be more of a kinetic chain as opposed to just an isolated, my shoulder hurts, the pain must be originating from the shoulder. Mm-hmm. That all is definitely the kinetic chain usage and evaluation and treatment of it.
So it sounds like you went from more of a systemic approach to a holistic approach.
Correct.
Yeah. And so along those, you know, thought processes, are there some other modalities that you brought in, not necessarily traditional modalities, but, you know, manipulation techniques, kinesio tape, Graston, A-STIM, active release? What are some of the things that you've brought into your practice to help you?
I've definitely brought in the kinesio taping, the Graston or soft tissue instrument assisted mobilization. Cupping is a new one that we're exploring right now in the clinics, as well as another soft tissue way of treating soft tissues. Michigan State was great. I had a solid foundation when it came to rehab and treatment, when it came to the mobilization and manipulation. I've definitely continued to expand upon that and utilizing the soft tissue techniques are the general what we use on a day-to-day basis.
And, you know, something that you mentioned before about evidence-based practice. So everything that you all do on campus, you aren't going to do unless the evidence shows that it's going to be an effective technique.
For the most part, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the athletic trainer's ability to understand evidence and interpret research and understand how to apply that is huge.
Correct.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear you say that because, you know, obviously our students are going through that class now, but you have a certain faction of athletic trainers, and I would say that they're part of the old guard, that they don't understand the importance of this. And, you know, some of the new leaders in the profession are coming about and saying, look, if the numbers support it, then obviously it's something that we need to do. On top of it, you know, it is a hard subject to understand, but once you do understand it and you're able to apply that and see its translational effectiveness, you're able to be a much better clinician.
I would agree.
Well, good. I'm glad you agree. I'm glad to hear that. I agree, too.
Jenna, would you mind sharing a story, you know, just something unique about an interaction or a treatment with an athlete, you know, that you found to be, you know, successful or that you're very proud of?
So there isn't. So we have permission. I spoke to the athlete, and he's given us permission to share this story. Back in 2010, we had an athlete, a speed skater, who during Olympic trials went down, and when he fell, his speed skate actually sliced his quad, practically sliced it in half, and it was.
Wow.
I believe it was very close to the saphenous vein, and it was an emergency surgery that was more or less done to save the leg and to save his life without really sport as a part of the thought process of repairing the quad. And he came down and worked with us, and I was privileged enough to be able to work with him very closely on a day-to-day basis. And his first race back, we brought him from, it was just so rewarding to be able to work with him and watch him go through all the hard work to go from being on crutches to his first race back on his skates was at the in a trials for a prelim game for the Olympics in Vancouver in 2010. So being able to be with that athlete and have that athlete come full circle was definitely very rewarding and really exciting.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. I mean, that is just amazing. And so can you talk about, obviously, speed skating is, you know, outside the realm of your traditional sport. So can you talk about some of the rehab techniques that you employed to get that return to play?
Sure. So with speed skating, one of the things that I learned very quickly, if I didn't know the sport, I'm going to go to the practice. I'm going to listen to the coach coaching. I want to see the technique. I want to see what they're doing actually on the ice, because I don't know what they're supposed to do. There's no way we're going to be able to replicate it on land. For speed skating, one of the biggest things that we used a lot is their turn belt. They are in such a low position with their center of gravity so far off to their left when they're turning that you can't replicate that unless you have support and assistance. Hmm. And they more or less just use a very long belt and you put it around, I would have it on my feet and I'm going to stay stationary, but then it allows that athlete to get actually into their turning position, and so you can actually see their specific biomechanics regarding that positioning. So using the turn belt during rehab became imperative for any lower extremity, primarily for those athletes, to help them get them back to sport.
And are you all employing, you know, some of the latest biomechanic techniques? So you guys are, you know, taking digital pictures with the markers and you're seeing where the joint positions are?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
We do that. We have a machine, a setup that has a treadmill with over 5,000 sensors underneath the treadmill belt. You can connect 9 motion sensors up to the athlete, and then we have 2 high-definition cameras we can capture from 2 different angles, and then the computer will pull together the biomechanical analysis and the numbers that we'll then take and interpret.
And what other markers are you all using? Are you using, you know, VO2 max, isokinetic data? What else are you all using?
We also, on the sports medicine side, we truly stay pretty clinical. We'll use the range of motions, active range of motions, core stability, core range of motion to look for either injury patterns and or help prevent injury if we see a huge muscle imbalance or imbalance when it comes to the range of motions of certain body parts. Mm-hmm. We also do have a sports performance and sports science team whose actually office is right above ours. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who primarily look at work on the VO2 max side of things.
So when you guys are looking at, you know, core deficits, are you employing FMS? Or are you employing a different test, or is it something that you all created?
It's one we created off the research, and we also adjusted based on the sport to make sure it is sport specific as possible.
The reason why I'm asking is that part of my job at UH is that I also work with the Astronaut Strength Conditioning and Rehabilitation Program at NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that we're looking at is FMS. And so is that, you know, is the core testing that you guys use, is that, can other clinicians get a hold of that? Can it be, you know, repeated? And, you know, are you guys willing to share that? You can say no, it's not going to hurt my feelings.
I don't know. I'll be honest. I don't know. I know we're still working and fine tuning our process and doing the assessments and evaluations with the athletes. And I don't feel as if right now we're at the publishing stage.
I understand.
That's interesting. I'm actually working on a grant right now that will allow me and Bill, the other athletic trainer here, and one of the athletic trainers from Dobie, to travel to Vancouver this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And be trained in FMS, because as Jenna was saying, it's more of a kinetic chain. It's more of a whole body approach rather than, oh, my knee hurts. Well, you know, I don't know what it is, but I'm just going to look at your knee.
Right.
Well, let me look at the ankle and the hip and figure out, okay, there's something going on somewhere else, or maybe the other side. And so we're actually looking to go get trained this summer so that we can assess each of our students and correct the muscular dysfunctions and things like that. And so.
So there's a biomechanist out in California by the name of Dr. Bill Whiting. And Dr. Bill Whiting, he wrote a book with Dr. Zernica, and it looks at biomechanics of injury. And one of the things that he describes is what's called Dizzy Dean syndrome. And Dizzy Dean syndrome is essentially a deficit in the kinetic chain. And Dizzy Dean was a baseball pitcher, and I think he got, you know, stubbed in the big toe by a baseball, and it altered his biomechanics, and he ends up, if I'm not mistaken, dislocating his glenohumeral joint, not because of some sort of trauma, because of that weakness in the kinetic chain. And that was the first time clinically that they had seen, oh, look at that. You know, the change in biomechanics of the foot and the ankle affected the knee, and that affected the hip, which affected the entire biomechanics, which put more stress on his glenohumeral joint, which, right, and down the line. And so, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things of, I think that when we come out of school in athletic training, we are, you know, trained to say, okay, we're going to assess each of these individual body parts. And we've got all these really cool, valid, and reliable tests to do that. But then to be able to step back and kind of get that 20, 30,000, you know, foot view to say, okay, now, you know, this has to be a holistic approach. We understand that your ankle is weak. Why is it weak? We've already addressed that. But there has to be some other stresses that occurred. One of the other things that stands out to me, too, is that they did some work out at USC, and they were looking at, I think, female jump patterns. What they discovered is for a long time, they were putting a lot of emphasis on, you know, the VMO, and they went away from that. And a couple biomechanists out at USC said, it's not the VMO, it's your gluteus medius, and let's look at your landing patterns and strengthen up the gluteus medius, and that will decrease the amount of ACL. And you know what? They're right. There was some validity to what they were doing. So, yeah, I think it's great. I think it's great. Well, I hate to cut this short, but I gotta head back. We gotta get out of here at noon.
Okay.
So, but right. If you guys want to keep talking, by all means.
Jenna, any parting thoughts there?
No, thank you so much for the opportunity. I had a lot of fun.
Jenna, how do I contact you? You know, I want to be able to share our information and talk a little bit more about this and get you more involved in our program. Is that, you want me to get your contact information from Jeremy?
Sure, that'd be perfect.
Great.
Yeah, I actually just met her on Twitter, just follow her on Twitter, and then that's how I said, hey, you want to do this? She said, sure. All right, well, let's do it.
And so you have Jenna's email address?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. And I'll shoot you an email.
Wonderful.
Jenna, thank you so much. This was a really, this was a real privilege to be able to talk to you. And what a unique circumstance that you and I both know Q. He's a great guy. He's doing wonderful things in the profession. And that just goes to show you that the athletic training world is not 6 degrees or 7 degrees, like Kevin Bacon said. It's like one or two.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it is.
Well, nice to meet you, Jenna.
Yes, thank you, Jenna.
Nice meeting you. Thanks for your time, you guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and close it out if you guys need
to. Yeah, close it out.
All right, so I don't have my show notes, so if I mess this up, it's all right. We definitely want to thank Jenna for coming on, the U.S. Olympic Training Center, for allowing her to do it. She had to get it cleared, and so for them being up for her or joining us on this, thank you for Dr. Josh Allen and Mark Knobloch for being such a big part of what we do here, for bringing students, because it really changes my perspective, because I'm not just teaching my high school students that may be interested in the profession, but I'm possibly influencing the lives of people who are really bought into becoming athletic trainers. And so it just really changes my motivation and the inspiration to do this. So thank you guys for being
Thanks for letting us be a part of it. And I can tell you, whether Will or Tashari decides to go into Olympics, they really got an incredible education over this last hour.
Right.
I mean, what a great experience. Mm-hmm. What a great experience.
And so, GHAT sponsors the CEU opportunities. You have to register beforehand and log in there. So, you can be earning CEUs while you're at lunch. So you guys, when you go on, you're crunched for CEU time or money later in your profession. There you go. You know where to come back to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. And again, that's sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. And if you want to find out more about Jenna, her Twitter is @JennaStreet. So it's @JennaStreet on Twitter. And then U of H, Masters of Athletic Training Program. Dr. Yellen, why don't you hit us up with that address?
www.hhp.edu/MAT. That's our website. Go on there. Learn all about us. We have a Facebook page. We've got a Twitter connected to that. If you're interested in pursuing your master's degree, entry-level master's in athletic training, come see us.
That's his favorite part of the whole show.
It is.
He's got that part down. All right, so for Jeremy and
Tashari,
Dr. Josh Yellen,
Will Ryan,
that's a wrap.